This talk was recorded at Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society in Los Angeles and is freely offered for your enjoyment. For more information, please visit againstthestream.org.
Well, it's good to see everybody here today on this potential rainy and cold day. I thought I'd start with a song to bring us into the mood, the correct mood, and then share a couple thoughts and then get right into the Dharma talk. And this song is a song that I found on YouTube. And it was written by a guy in England who for 2 years had been a Catholic seminary student. And so this song sort of relates to that in a way. But it wasn't Buddhist enough for me. So I decided to change some of the words and make it more Buddhist. Now, it's not against any particular religion. It's just simply an insight that a Buddhist might have in reflecting on why they were Buddhist, as opposed to a Christian, a Jew, or a Muslim. So having said all that, Jesus doesn't want me, and the devil, he don't care. God is in his heaven, and the Holy Spirit's out there somewhere. Buddha just sits and smiles so kindly. I just figured it out, and finally, Jesus don't love me, and the devil don't even care. Jesus wants to save my soul, Satan wants it too. Devil and an angel sitting on the shoulder telling me just what to do. The one on the left says do the right thing, the one on the other says to hell with him. How am I to know which one to do? Jesus doesn't want me, and the devil, he don't care. God is in his heaven, and the Holy Spirit's out there somewhere. Buddha just sits and smiles so kindly. I just figured it out, and finally, Jesus don't love me, and the devil don't even care. All my life I've tried my best to win and never lose, but no one sits on shoulders. It's up to me to choose. When I found a Buddha way, I lost all fearful thought, with heart so full and mind so still, never to get caught. Now I know which way I am to choose. Jesus doesn't want me, and the devil, he don't care. God is in his heaven, and the Holy Spirit's out there somewhere. Buddha just sits and smiles so kindly. I just figured it out, and finally, Jesus don't love me, and the devil don't even care. Jesus don't love me, and the devil don't even care. Yeah. So, having sung that song, a couple thoughts. The first thought is, I was at Leisure World yesterday, where all the old people live, 7,000 all together, and talking about Buddhism and the Dharma. And one guy said in our discussion group, he said, it's really a shame that so many people have wasted lives. He had been successful in his career. He was in entertainment. He was a writer, a producer and stuff. And I thought to myself, does anybody really have a wasted life? And then I thought to the Military School Alumni Association I joined up with last year. And each year they send you a roster of all the cadets that have contacted them and what classes, what class they graduated in, and what they did in life. And it was a private school, and I was there not because I was a good student and getting ready for college, but I was there because I was a jerk. And this was to make a man out of me. And it actually did something positive. But as I was looking at the choices everybody made, it's really interesting how many people ended up as garbage people or, you know, garage mechanics. One guy drove a truck. Another guy was a foreman in a warehouse. And you're just thinking, I thought to myself, gosh, all these people went to this sort of private school, and a lot of them went to college, and then they ended up, you know, being in a warehouse. And is that a wasted life? And I thought to myself, probably not. I think a lot of them were probably stuck in time and place. That if you don't want to leave your hometown, if you don't want to leave your friends and family behind, you're going to take what's available to you to make a living. And some of us, probably most of us, weren't born here, and we ended up moving to the big city, L.A., you know, 4 million, 5 million people, giant population base, a lot of stuff to do, a lot of chances for career. But family and friends are difficult to find in a huge metropolis like this. And even if you create your own family, they may be distracted by all the flash and trash of L.A. as well. So isn't it interesting how we make all these choices? And are there really any winners or losers in life in what you decide to do? I think one of the greatest inventions was the second career. You know, that you have your first career and you do all the things you're supposed to do, and you expect it to have a certain outcome, and it never seems to quite turn out the way it was supposed to. And then at some point you might say to yourself, the hell with it. I'm just going to do what I want to do. Even if I make less money, I'm still going to have a better time doing it. And so some of us, you know, live our passion. Find something to do that actually benefits us and others and inspires us beyond money and prestige. So I guess the first part of our life maybe is, you know, we're all going to do what opportunities are available to us, or do what we think we should do, and then the second half of our life, we might get a chance to do what we really, I don't want to say should be doing, but find out what we could be doing. And so when I talk to the Leisure World people, all these people have already done all this stuff, you know. They're like retirement now, and they're just like reflecting on the next class they're going to take in knitting, or, you know, they have so many clubs there. It's just amazing. You know, and I was telling Holly earlier that they're going to put my picture in the newspaper, and the Leisure World newspaper, and so they'll talk about the Buddhist meditation circle. We're going to call it a circle instead of a group, so now they'll know what car to throw the tomatoes at when I come through the gates. You know, there's the Buddhist guy. Look at him. The second thought that comes is the thought about how difficult it is to have pets. That they are so wonderful. And yet we all know they just don't live long enough. They always die too soon. You know, and you might think, I was talking to a woman yesterday at Leisure World. Her cat was 20 when she was dead, when she finally died. She had this cat for 20 years. And it had been last year that the cat died, but you could just see the tears sort of swell up as she reflected on how important a relationship she had had with her cat. So for the Buddhist, it comes down to when your cat or dog or pigeon or mouse, whatever you consider to be a pet, is dying, what do we do? If you know what the first precept is, it's not to take life. So do we interfere with the natural cause and consequence of life and maybe put the little guy down so he or she won't have to suffer? And then we go back to the first precept, and the first precept says, you know, you can't do that because you can't take life. So what are we to do, you know? And so I've had to put down two animals in the last year and a half. And it's fairly inexpensive from a consumer standpoint. But It sure does break your heart, and it sure does take you a while to get over it. And so I thought to myself, well, you know, the Mahayana tradition, which is a little different than the Vipassana tradition, has something called the Bodhisattva ideal. And the Bodhisattva ideal is to take a vow to save all sentient beings, and to save them from suffering, but also to save them from life and death. That ultimately nirvana is the end of life and death, and allows us to exist because of nirvana and not creation. But until we get there, the Bodhisattva is out in the field every day, working on helping others end their suffering. And so it may be wrong to kill, but is it wrong to end suffering from a Buddhist perspective? And the Bodhisattva ideal gives you a workaround. You know, the computers are so great because not everything works in every computer. And so there's always little workarounds you can do to make the thing work on your computer. And so the workaround for this situation would be skillful means. You see, you're using skillful means to end suffering. And as a bodhisattva, you're taking responsibility for what you're doing. So any karmic consequences that may come your way, you embrace them. Because that's the price you pay for ending suffering. Now, not everybody's willing to pay the price. So there you go. But if you have a pet, you might be willing to pay the price. And we don't know what the price is because we don't know how many good actions we've done in the past that may neutralize the taking of a life because of the end of suffering. And so it could turn out to be the right thing to do. And it could turn out to be the wrong thing to do. And you will only know that as time goes by. So it's a courageous path the Bodhisattva takes, to end all suffering, not knowing the consequences of that activity. And so I can't tell you whether you should do it or shouldn't do it. I don't know. And I don't know when the proper time would be. When is the proper time to take a life? Is it 2 days before they die? A week before they die? Is it 5 days after they've stopped eating food? Or 7 days after they've stopped drinking water? When is the proper time? You may not know, but your heart will help your intellect come to a place of skillfulness. And that's why in Buddhism we have wisdom and compassion. You got to have both. Now, what's the second thought? The Dharma talk. It's about the five hindrances. And people talk about the five hindrances a lot. And I mean, it's so hard to meditate anyway. And not only is it hard to meditate, but we have these five things that really prevent us from having a good meditation. You know? And so through the centuries, they've come up with this model of the five hindrances and what to do about them. And ultimately, the five hindrances go away. You know? Just because you've achieved nirvana, or you've become a stream enterer, or you've become a non-returner. There are four levels in early Buddhism, Theravada Buddhism, four levels of nirvana. There's the stream enterer level, there's the once returner level, there's the non-returner level, and there's the arahant, someone who has finally achieved nirvana, never to fall back again into suffering, old age, sickness, and death. So we have sense door desire. We have ill will, we have sloth and laziness, we have restlessness and worry, and we have skeptical doubt as the five roadblocks to a really good meditation. And so what I'd like to do is talk a little bit about those roadblocks, but before I get there, skeptical doubt is eliminated at the first level of nirvana. When you become a stream enterer, which in the texts say you only have seven more lifetimes to go at the most before you achieve your nirvana, you lose your skeptical doubt. Now you know for sure that this is going to work. When you become a non-returner, which is the third stage of nirvana, before you fully achieve nirvana, you will lose sense door desire, you will lose ill will, and you will lose remorse. But that's the third level. So we're going to have that for a long time. Finally, when you become an arahant and have achieved nirvana, you finally lose your laziness. And you finally lose your restlessness and worry. But that goes last. So I guess we need to be prepared for this. We need to be ready for this. This stuff isn't going to go away. But can we work with it? Can we do something about it as we sit and meditate? Now, as I was going through some talks on this, I came upon a couple sentences that really just started me thinking in a different way. And you know how that feels sometimes when you've been studying something and reading something and you're just about ready to get it. It's almost there. And then you read something and it just turns everything upside down and you go, geez, you know, now I've got to go there. It's like all these different layers that we keep peeling back. We find this, we find that. So this is one of those layers. This deals with sense door desire. Now, how many sense doors do we have as a Buddhist? We have 6 sense doors as a Buddhist. We even have more than Christians. So our sense doors, I like that, I'm sorry. Our sense doors are sight, and sound, and smell, and taste, and touch, and mind. Mind is considered a sense door in Buddhism. Okay. So this is the paragraph, the couple sentences I found that really got me thinking differently. Sensory desire refers to that particular type of wanting that seeks for happiness through the 5 senses of sight, sound, smell, taste, and physical feeling. It specifically excludes any aspiration for happiness through the 6th sense door of mind alone. Now, this is Achan Brahm from Australia, who's well known and respected. So apparently, a mind can create desires. It's not a specific sense door that will allow us to go after, for instance, with eye, the sense door of the eye, go after attractive and be repulsed by unattractive. So we have attachment, we have aversion. And each of the sense doors has this duality of attachment and aversion. And attachment is a desire, and aversion is a desire, and so we're either going towards or going away from. Now, as I was thinking about this, I'm thinking, okay, well, that makes perfect sense as we're walking down the street, and then we pass a newsstand, you know, and there on the cover of, you know, Tiger Beat is Jennifer Lopez. And, you know, the sense door desire of attachment arises, you know, and you lose your balance just for a moment and you continue to walk. And then do we have enough discipline from our meditation practice to ride the wave of desire until it finally turns back into the ocean and lets us free again? Well, it takes practice to do that. Other times we're just like so into it. They just did a study that was published that men who are perceiving a beautiful woman sometimes forget what they want to say next and become sort of stupid. So, how powerful is this stuff that we're dealing with? This is really powerful stuff. This is like the magic of humankind, you know, that it just transforms us into imbeciles, you know? Don't know what to do next. So I could understand that. So I can see the sense doors as being open all the time, and I'm hungry, so I'm walking down the street, and I smell bakery. But there's a bar, and I have no desire to go into the bar and drink, but I do have a desire to walk into the bakery because I'm hungry, and it smells so good. So it's sort of a selective kind of attachment or desire, you know? And our whole life is the sense doors are always open, except when we're sleeping. And they're always open, and they're always taking all this information, and we're being driven by it. And the marketers and know about this. Marketing is really cool because they have done scientific studies to see how we're attracted and what makes us have aversion. And so they always want us to go towards that. But now we're going to sit in meditation at Against the Stream. We're going to sit for 35, 40 minutes quietly. And ultimately, if we focus on our object of meditation long enough, our sense doors literally close. That ultimately, as we go into jhana, deep states of tranquility, we're not going to be able to hear anything, or see anything, or taste anything, or smell anything, or touch anything. We're going to be totally closed down. So why is it so hard to meditate? If the sense doors are closed down and not taking any new information in, who's the culprit in this? It seems to me that it's that sixth sense door that doesn't generate its own desire, but takes the desire from the other five sense doors and starts working it into a story. You know? So I can remember back in the 80s when I used to meditate at the center where I now live. Now we'd go in there and it might be cold and overcast like this, and you'd start meditating. And sometimes it was just really uncomfortable. And so I would have this sort of vision arise in my mind of going to Rhino Records. Now, it used to be on Westwood Boulevard, and they have all these old CDs and records and stuff and great prices. And I would imagine myself going through the aisles, the blues aisle in particular, and finding some classic that everybody has overlooked but me. And it's only $3. And the joy of this great deal and then taking it back to where I lived and listening to it and thinking what a great evening this was. And sure enough, you know, they would ring the final gong and I would leave to go back to my apartment, but on the way back to my apartment, I would go to Rhino Records. And I'd spend $30. And I'm thinking to myself, gosh, you know, I don't know if I can afford to meditate. You know? So I think there's something that's connected with past and future, with these sense doors, that's the connection to the consciousness that we have. That doesn't generate its own desire, but takes all this other information, this aversion and attraction from the other five sense doors, and creates this desire while we're doing nothing. You know? Doing nothing, and we have all this great desire arising. So how do we get past that? How do we get past sense door desire? Well, you may not like this, but this comes from your tradition. This comes from the Vipassana tradition. The first thing, if you want to sort of balance it all out, is you need to meditate on stuff that's impure, that's just really disgusting. You need to think about that bakery and the mold that you didn't see and how sick you got when you finally ate it and how often you threw up afterwards. And that balances that desire for that moldy muffin that probably isn't moldy at all. You know? And so what you're doing is you're using the negative aspects and you're trying to bring that desire into a place of neutrality. You're not trying to kill the desire necessarily, but just bringing it back into balance so it's workable and it doesn't direct your life in the way it did before. Okay. So, and then devoting yourself to the meditation on the impure. So each time you sit and meditate, it's not about the breath, but it's about emphysema. And you get to this sort of place, and that's why some Vipassana students aren't smiling very much. Because they're like into this stuff to find balance, you know. And you get these little Zen people, and they're sort of like mellow, almost too mellow, and they're not happy either. And then you get to the Pure Land people who just chant Amitabha Buddha, and they're always smiling because they're going to heaven. You know? They're leaving all this stuff behind. So, guarding the sense doors. So walking past the magazines, walking past the bakery, guarding the sense doors, realizing if something comes up, that you've got to guard your first impulse to attach to it. And I find this a lot if I'm at temples. Because, you know, if you're wearing the robes and you have your hair short and everybody's watching you all the time just to see how many precepts you're going to break in that day. And so I'm sitting there and I might be giving a Dharma talk or I might be meditating or I might be getting ready to present. And then this really, you know, beautiful woman walks by and she's sort of, you know, seductively walking slowly. And without knowing it, I might just look up and there's the image of, you know, beauty and attachment, and then I have to look right away. I just, you know, have to look at something else. Because if my sense doors linger too long in this image, the stories start to happen. You know, maybe I could meet her after the Dharma talk, you know. So you have to be really careful. And so guarding your sense doors is important so the stuff doesn't catch you by surprise. Moderation in eating. Now, I've been doing it for some reason. I don't know why. I just lately in the last year, I've been eating less and enjoying it more, actually. Because if you don't eat a lot, every time you do eat, it's just marvelous, you know. And so I find that in my moderation of eating, I do have less desire because I don't have the energy to create the desires anymore. <You know? laughs> So starvation is a good way. And then noble friendship. Hanging out with people who have been practicing longer than you have. You know? Picking up on how they're doing it. What are they doing when these sense desires arise? How are they reacting and responding to them? What can you learn from them? And you can learn from them, and they don't have to say anything about what they're doing. You can simply observe what they're doing. And rather than telling you, they're telling you by what they don't do from a Buddhist perspective rather than what they do do. So Buddhism is always about not doing. We're not going to have killing. We're not going to have stealing. It's never about what we're going to do. And for me, that works even better. Okay, the second problem with our meditation practice is anger and ill will. Have you ever tried to meditate when you're angry at somebody? And all you do is think about the many different ways you can ruin their life. You know? And then you get up and you go out to find them, you know? And you just go, okay, something's wrong with this. How can I balance my ill will and hatred? What do I need to do? Well, you know, they go into a very general way of dealing with ill will. They talk about cultivating meditation, loving kindness. And I talked about that last month, how to cultivate loving kindness. And that's a really good way to balance your hatred and anger. You know, but sometimes it takes a long time to cultivate loving kindness. It takes months, if not years. And if you're sitting every day, or at least once a week, ill will, anger and hatred may be with you each time. And you may not want to spend so much time. So, what do I do? The first thing I try to do is have patience. Patience with myself for feeling the hatred and anger. Because I know I'm not supposed to feel the hatred and anger. I know I'm working on a path that will eventually deliver me to a place of love and kindness, wisdom and compassion. And how wonderful will that be? But now I'm sitting in hatred and anger. And I need to have patience with myself because those thoughts had a beginning, they have an existence, and they will have a death. They will not last forever, though sometimes they can last for a really long time. Yesterday, it turns out, Dick Cheney had a heart transplant. Could this be the first time he's had a heart? I don't know. But you see that hatred and anger? It's still there. That little ill will just comes up. So it's a tough one. So patience. Patience with yourself. Then a technique that I like to use is forgiveness. You know, I forgive me for thinking like that, but I forgive them for making me think like that. And again, they didn't make me think like that. I should accept full responsibility, but I'm not there yet. I can't accept it, so I forgive them and I forgive me. And what does forgiveness do? This is really the most important lesson today, I think. Father Gill, who used to be a member of the Archdiocese of Los Angeles, he was the interreligious director, and he was a really nice guy. Unfortunately, he was dying, and he had the cancer, but he didn't stop him. He was such a busy guy. So we were having an interreligious dialogue, a Buddhist-Catholic dialogue, and I proudly said to him, you know, I think Buddhism is better than Catholicism. And he was so kind, he just let me keep talking. You know? And he said, well, why do you think that way, Kusla? I said, well, you know, we don't have forgiveness, we have acceptance. And I think acceptance is better than forgiveness, Father Gill, because forgiveness means the one forgiving has a higher position than the one being forgiven. And acceptance means you're both at the same level. There's no higher or lower. So Father Gill paused for a moment and said, well, Kusla, what does forgiveness and acceptance do? What's the end result of both of those? And I said, well, I don't know, Father Gill. I really haven't thought it through that far. And he says, well, let me share with you what I understand. Forgiveness and acceptance brings a relationship back into balance. Forgiveness and acceptance brings a relationship back into balance. And the problem with ill will is our relationship is out of balance. So, having said that, patience, forgiveness, and ultimately acceptance. And acceptance then brings that ill will and hatred and anger to a place that's manageable, to a place that doesn't affect you in a negative way. Laziness. Oh, man. It is hard to meditate every day, isn't it? Hard to get up early if you have a busy schedule. Hard to stay up late. Because you want to be clear and you want to be energetic. You want to have a good meditation. The more I meditate, I'm not quite sure what that is yet. But you want to be present. And you want to be engaged in your meditation practice. And if you're really sort of tired and would just rather sleep, it may not be good. But again, good is a value we give to something that has no value. So can we meditate and get past our laziness and our sloth? And yes, there are certain techniques. And one of my favorite techniques is death. I'll be dead. I won't be able to do this anymore. I'll sleep tomorrow. Maybe I should just be a little more energetic because I'm still alive today. Death is a good incentive to do stuff. Yeah. It inspires you, you know. It's good. But if you don't want to get into death, you know, because it can sure lead to depression. You can reflect on these qualities. Overeating can cause you to be lazy and slothful. And isn't that the best way to be lazy and slothful? You know, you have a big meal, and that nap is so good afterwards. So maybe eating less will prevent you from wanting to go and taking a nap. Changing your body position. If you're meditating and you're starting to go to sleep, and some people can sleep while they're meditating. Have you seen that? They don't even fall over. They just bounce a little bit. You know, it's just amazing. So maybe if you're sitting, maybe you could be like do you know a walking meditation to sort of you know raise the energy a bit, and then go back to your sitting meditation. Thinking or perceiving light. Now, if you're in a room that has a light on. You could simply open your eyes to stimulate your brain, to sort of invigorate you a bit. There's also an inner light as well, and some of you have probably found it. We all have this sort of inner light that's available to us. And sometimes it can be a supernova. That's a drastic inner light. You may not want to bathe yourself in that too long. But there are little inner lights, too, that go on and off. And simply being aware of those and focusing on that. If you have a breath as your object of meditation, maybe changing it to your inner light for a while. Stimulate your brain and then go back to your breath. Staying in the open air, meditating outside. If you meditated outside today, you'd stay awake. Noble friendship and suitable conversation. They talk a lot about noble friendship in early Buddhism. It's really important to hang around the right people, you know? And eventually you'll be one of those right people. And people will seek you to hang out with. Good luck with that. Restlessness and worry. Oh, wow, this is with us all the time. And you know what's happening next month? Tax day. You know? And I don't have to worry about it too much because I don't pay taxes because I don't make enough money to pay taxes. So, but I have to worry about not making enough money to pay taxes. Because I don't have a lot of money for a lot of stuff. So, you know, I have to choose wisely and stuff. So there's always, you know, should I go to the movie or should I watch it on, you know, the computer? You know, $18 as compared to $2. Or should I just borrow it from somebody? What are we going to do? And then the worry of just health worries. We all have health worries, you know, we're too thin, we're not thin enough, our hair is falling out, we wish we had more hair. Whatever your health worry is, hopefully it's not a chronic health worry. Sitting in meditation is a perfect environment, you know, to generate these worries. You know, it's like a petri dish, you know, and the fungus is growing, and it's so quiet, and it's, you know, and the Buddha is smiling at you, and the incense is burning, and all you can think about is, I'm going to die, and this thing, you know, wow. So how do we get past this stuff, these worries? Well, what they say, and I think this is really good, knowledge of the Buddhist scriptures. You know, if you start reading the Dharma, and it can be translations, or it could be interpretations, or it could be commentary, or it could be like, you know, a literal translation of the Pali. In understanding the Dharma, what you find, there isn't too much to worry about. You know, the Dharma sets it up perfectly. You're going to get born because of karma. You're going to get old. You're going to get sick, and you're going to die. So why worry? We already know how it's going to turn out. We just don't know when. So the Dharma is like a salve. It's just sort of, it's peaceful, and you reflect, yeah, I'm going to be sick. And when you get sick, you know, you hope you have enough money for health care. And that may be changing. You know, we don't know. You know, I get a kick out of people that have health care, who say, well, it's really not necessary to have health care, but they have it. You know? And maybe one day we'll all have health care, and then we'll all get sick and be able to go someplace and get well and not have to die. You know? So asking questions, you know, about the Dharma is a good way to get rid of your worry. That if you have a teacher or a monk or someone who's practiced or read more than you have, ask them some questions. Get involved in a discussion of the Dharma. See what they think about stuff. See if they're worried in the same way you're worried. Bring up some of your fears and anxiety and see if that applies to them. Because maybe it doesn't in the same way because they've read more or practiced more or understood more about the Dharma than you have. Association with those of mature age and experience. That's why I go to Leisure World. I'm hanging out with all these old, wise people, you know? I'm old, too, and I'm working on getting wise. But, you know, they have a much different way of looking at stuff than the young people do, you know, than the very young people do. And it's sort of nice to hear their perspective, you know? And they may think it has more value than it does, and granted it might be difficult to listen to sometimes, but there is wisdom in what they have to say and how they've come to a place of acceptance with their life. What they're telling you is how they did it, how they made those choices, They had different things to choose from than we do, but they still had to make choices. And sometimes that allows us not to worry as much about what's going to happen in the future, because we see in them our future. And sometimes we see people that are very comfortable in their old age. And that is such a gift. If you find somebody who's old and comfortable, what a gift that is. Houston Smith, he wrote many books on religion. I consider him just a really interesting and fascinating fellow. Besides being well-respected and knowledgeable, he wrote The World Religions, and that's the book I read to find Buddhism, one small chapter on Buddhism. And he was at UCLA, and I was there, and I was invited to a dinner that he was going to give a presentation to. And I went up to him before the dinner. He was sitting out on the patio. He's an old guy now. He's in his 80s. He had a hip replacement, so he can't walk too well. And I just said, I want to thank you for making me a Buddhist, because it was the book that you wrote and the chapter referring to Buddhism that allowed me to find Buddhism and investigate it and come to a place of understanding that's the religion I want it to be. And he said, well, thank you very much. But when he looked up at me, his eyes were smiling. He had smiling eyes. Have you ever seen smiling eyes on old people? It's really an amazing thing, because they've seen it all. And his body is starting to deteriorate now, and now he's got, you know, the metal in his joints, and he's going, whoa, it is possible to be happy and old. It is possible to be wise and comfortable and to be old. Jimmy Carter is the same way. If you ever get a chance to look at Jimmy Carter in his eyes are smiling too. So I want my eyes to smile when I'm 80. And this practice allows us to get there. We don't need to worry about it. We just need to do it. But of course, that is the hardest part, after all. Now we have the last one is skeptical doubt. And how do we get past our skeptical doubt? We need to investigate and experiment with the Dharma. And the Buddha gave us permission to do this. He said, don't believe it just because I said it. Don't believe it because it works. Don't believe it because a bunch of old people tell you. Don't believe it because you read it in a book. He said, believe it because you wanted to investigate the truth behind the Dharma. And you wanted to see if it works for you. And you sit down and you say to myself, okay, I have ill will towards this person. Maybe I'm going to try to practice a little patience or forgiveness and to see what the outcome is, to see how I feel afterwards, to see if this stuff really works or it's just a bunch of words and models and a way to make a living if you give retreats. And as it turns out, the stuff does work. And that's why, as a stream enterer, the first level of nirvana, your skeptical doubt is washed away. You no longer have faith in Buddhism. What you have instead is confidence. Confidence that the Dharma will work for you because you have proven it to be true. If somebody practices the Dharma and it's not true for them, that's okay too. Maybe they need to be a Christian or a Jew or a Muslim. Or a Wiccan. You know, we find our truth in many places. And the truth is not the same for everybody. And I don't think there is one truth, because Buddhism is not monotheistic. One is not the best place to be. You know, I just makes me want to go, oh, when they say we're one with everything. And I'm going, how boring is that? I want to be unique and separate, yet connected. I want community. I don't want uniformity. You know, and so Buddhism approaches it that way. Uniqueness is not a deficit. Uniqueness is part of being who we are. And it's honored in Buddhism. But the connection of who we are with everyone else is honored as well. So we have a relative and an ultimate understanding of what it means to be a Buddhist. So these five hindrances can be worked with in our practice. But we need to be aware when the hindrances arise. We need to have a game plan. We need to have a little knowledge on what might be the antidote to bring us back into balance again. And ultimately, what we'll find is a place of acceptance with these five hindrances. That we accept the fact that they will arise, we accept the fact that they will exist for a while, and we accept the fact that they will die. And they may come back again, but the further along the path we get, the less likely it is that they will come back with the same intensity. I'm going to stop there.
You have just listened to a podcast from Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society. If you'd like to make a contribution to help support these teachings, please visit againstthestream.org.